Good morning, everyone. Jay Compulsive over here, and I am so grateful to be here. Thank you very much. Beat me with a feather because this is my first time I've actually spoken, told my story in OA. I want to share with you a photo or two of where I used to be. This was me in the islands, practicing two of my addictions, a glass of wine in one hand, and as you can see, no neck, and really pushing the boundaries of that shirt. And I'll show you one more picture, and then we'll, just for you to realize where I came from. This picture I like, again, back in the islands. What I like about this picture is again, the no neck. And the reason I refer to the no neck twice is because I wear a necklace these days, every day, to remind myself that I have a neck today. And that's a direct result of the work that I've done, you know, in this program. I am closing in on what we call a healthy body weight. And with that, that has brought a whole nother aspect of recovery, into my OA experience. What is normal? You know, and I've had to do a lot of work with my nutritionist and reading some OA literature to just find out where my healthy body weight is. You know, my food addictions aren't just what's on my plate, but it's really what's going on within my head and my heart. So let me get started here, and I like to say that I started my issues when I was age 12, but seriously, to be honest with you, that's when I started handling it with some really bad behaviors when I was 12. I've always been a overweight person. I come from a family that was overweight. I come from a family that we were a race of big boned people, if you can understand that term. You know, I was recently on a trip visiting some family, a post-COVID trip down in the Carolinas, and I was visiting family. And they are still using that term to justify the obesity of my nephews and nieces, that we're just a family of big boned people. And I just wanted to look at them and say, wait a minute, that's such a lie. Look at me. I am part of this family, and I am not one of these big boned people that we speak of. It's just that as a family, our addictions are out of control. When I was 12, I was pushing over 200 pounds, and I watched a documentary on Karen Carpenter, and that was on her life of anorexia and bulimia. And instead of being repulsed, I remember going watching that and saying, "I can do that." And I used bulimia from that point on for most of my life to control my weight. I got so experienced, if you will, with purging that I didn't need implements anymore. I could force my body to purge itself with just constricting the muscles in my chest. I have purged, binged and purged as many times as I would, probably about 50 times in a day. So I controlled my weight through the bulimia. I went through high school. I joined the military, still controlling my weight with the bulimia. I entered a program. It's a Christian-based program. I won't mention what it was, but in that program, I started talking to others about my bulimia. That was the first time ever that I was talking to another human being about this particular issue. And the act of telling other people really made a difference, really worked when it came to that issue. I did stop purging. But when I left that program and I didn't have any other program around me, the compulsive eating took its place. So when I say that I'm a compulsive eater, I am multiple things. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm a bulimic. I'm a restrictor because I can really understand the whole concept of restricting. And I'm a compulsive eater because all of those other things are based on the fact that I can't control what I eat once I get started, especially some specific foods. So I entered, I got sober on the 20th of February in 20. This was just after the pandemic. And I was working my steps in that fellowship. And I love the steps. That's where my health is found. So there was one day I was sitting in my office, and one of the things I had taught my family, now this is my OA out of control person. I had taught my family to always have chocolate for me in the freezer. And I had used, there's a big book sitting around here somewhere. I had used page 133 and 134 as a club over my family, telling them that, see, it says it here in the big book that I must have chocolate and candies at my availability at all times. No, it didn't. Not at that point. Not a year beyond my recovery date. I didn't need it. I was using it as a club. And that for that, I needed to make an amends for later on. So they always had this for me. So I'm sitting in my office, and I have, I have a handful of these candies, chocolates in my hand. I unwrapped one and I shoved it into my mouth. And while I'm doing that, while I'm eating, I'm unwrapping the next one. And I had a moment of clarity at that moment. And I realized, oh my God, my face was flushed. My heart was quickening. I was excited about the next piece. I was grateful for what I was eating. And I said, I am having the same physical reactions as if I was pouring a shot of whiskey. And it was at that moment of clarity, that I realized that I had a problem with food. I knew it all my life, but this is when I finally realized I need some help. I didn't know what to do, so I didn't do anything about it all week long. A week passed. The next Sunday was an Easter morning. I remember it specifically because the issue was I got up out of my bedroom, I came out to my living room. And another thing I had taught my family to do was to always have an Easter basket for me. Now, I am a 55, 56-year-old man. I have no need for an Easter basket. But I had taught my family, and that's what I'm getting at, is I had taught my family to feed, if you will, my addictions, So they had this Easter basket for me. And I stood there and I looked at it and I said, there is so much immediate pleasure in that basket, but there is so much condemnation, so much self-loathing, so much horrible feelings that I would experience by touching that basket. And I, rather than that, I stood there and I surrendered and called out to the God of my understanding and said, I need help. I don't know what to do. But I can't, I can see I can't touch that basket, but I don't know what to do, but I surrender this food addiction to you. I never did touch that Easter basket. I put it into the freezer And somehow the family just made it go away. I can't tell you exactly how it happened, but with it, that was a Sunday. And by that Wednesday, I was in an OA newcomers meeting. It was an orientation meeting for Connecticut. And I've been with OA ever since. I answered the 15 questions. I answered 14 out of the 15 questions to the affirmative. I knew right off the bat there was no question in my mind that I was a compulsive eater. And I was a member at that moment of OA. Now, what do I do? That's how I got here. But what do I do to maintain recovery in OA? Well, it's a lot of work. And sometimes it's a lot of work, but at other times it's pretty easy, because when it becomes very easy, those are the times when I'm totally depending upon my higher power in each moment for the strength to do this. When it becomes work, that's when I'm taken aback upon myself, thinking that I can do this. I have all the pieces to the puzzle. I know where to put all the pieces. And I can do this. This is falling back into my restricting, controlling behavior. But when I find myself getting up in the morning and getting in touch with my higher power and turning it all over to him, including my food plan, life goes a lot more smoothly. And that's a continuing lesson that I'm learning all the time. I do a lot of traveling. Throughout the United States and in the Caribbean. So I do a lot of travel. One of the things that I do is that I bring my food plan with me. When I'm traveling domestically, I usually have a lunch box that I can pack several days worth of food with me. Or when I'm on an extended trip, I have a food plan that I can put together in those situations. I want to share an experience I had with traveling. Last Thanksgiving, I did a spur of the moment trip from New England to Akron, Ohio. I had the holiday weekend, the Thanksgiving weekend off, last minute from work. So I decided to take a road trip out to Akron. I wanted to see the AA sites. And meet a lot of my Zoom friends. It took me 10 hours. I traveled on Thanksgiving. I got up to my hotel and I had my abstinent meal with me. And I was invited by several of my Zoom friends to have Thanksgiving at their house. And this was my first Thanksgiving in recovery. And I was nervous and I didn't know what to do. So I talked to my sponsor, my OA sponsor. And my original plan was to sit in my hotel room, relax from the trip, have my abstinent Thanksgiving meal, and watch some football. And then later on in the evening, go to a meeting with a new Zoom friend of mine. And my sponsor said, "What's wrong with plan number one? Why do you need to go? Why would you feel you need to go with these people and have food at their houses?" He said, "What's wrong with sticking with your original plan?" So that's what I did. But that's how I use sponsorship in my life to help me stay on the track that I want to stay. I'm not sure how, I don't know where I stand, but let me share with you a slogan that I live by. It says, "Abstinence alone will not provide me with the spiritual experience that I need to recover. Abstinence and the steps will provide me the spiritual experience that I need to overcome this disease and be happy." Now, what does that mean? That means to me that the nine tools are very valuable to me. That the nine tools help me to be abstinent, be food sober, be absent. The nine tools do that foundation for me. But I personally can't stop there. That
The
the
five
nine
minutes
tool,
left.
perfect. Perfect. The nine tools cannot be the basis of my recovery. That's just for me. I can't say I'm a sober member of OA because I've done the nine tools. I need the nine tools to launch me into the steps. It's the steps is where I find recovery. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples of my favorite steps, my favorite steps with examples, and then we'll close. The step two was one of my first favorite step, and that's, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I thought when I came into these rooms, I thought I had all this spiritual knowledge. I had been in recovery for a very long time. But my sponsor, my OA sponsor, helped me with teaching me a prayer called the set-aside prayer. And he asked me to really set aside everything that I knew about me, about recovery, about the big book, about God, about everything. And I truly adopted that prayer. I'll give you a word picture. If I was sitting at this desk and I took my arm and I swiped everything off of this desk and cleared the slate on this desk, that's exactly what I did emotionally, spiritually, with all of my belief systems. I did that with that prayer. I set aside everything that I thought I knew so I could have a new experience. And I've had one. I shared the value of step six and seven. That's how I got into here was, when I was sitting in my office and I was having that moment of clarity, that was my higher power through step six and seven in my other fellowship, telling me, giving me fair warning, tapping me on the shoulder. I'm coming for the food. I'm just giving you fair warning. I'm coming for the food. That wasn't my doing. That was my relationship with my higher power working step six and seven in that fellowship. He was beginning to address that. And then he brought me to OA because this was a bigger problem than just having the problem removed. And for that, I'm grateful. Step nine, I want to share with you an experience that I had with step nine. And step nine is my favorite step. Out of all the steps, it's my favorite step because it's the miracle step. Step nine is where my recovery goes from being a personal thing between me, my sponsor, and God, a very personal thing. And I go out to the world. I start knocking on doors. I start interacting with people, and I start cleaning up the mess. So years ago, I was out in Las Vegas. I went to a convention and I treated some people horribly, a couple of vendors. I treated them horribly. And it got to the point where security was called and they were going to throw me out of the convention for the rest of the week if I didn't leave that scene immediately. It was that bad. So a couple of months ago, I decided to go to another convention out in Chicago. Now, these two men that I offended were on my amends list, but they were in my impossible column because I didn't know how I was going to ever see these people again.
You have 1 minute
Right?
left.
Perfect. So I decided to go to this convention in Chicago. The next thing I knew, it dawned on me that these same vendors were going to be at this other convention. So I flew out to Chicago. I got to the convention, and the first thing I did was I found these people, and when the moment was right, I went up and I made my amends to these people. And when I was about 20 feet away from their booth, they looked up and they saw me, and I could see the look of fear in their face because they were like, "Oh my God, it's that person from Vegas." And when I went up to them and I told them that I was righting a wrong, that I owned that stuff from Vegas, that and I asked for their forgiveness and asked if there was anything I can do to make it right. And all they really wanted to know was if I was okay. The beauty of doing that amends is that the next time, the next convention that I'm at and I see them and they see me walking up to their booth, they're not going to remember the first time. They're going to remember the second time. They're
Next
going to
time.
remember that. Okay, perfect. I wish I could go on. This has been great. You guys are wonderful. I absolutely love this fellowship, and be well. Thank you.